Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Pickle Patch, Bubbler, Tavern Belly, Brats. Wisconsinites have regularly employed a colorful and unique vocabulary thanks to multiple waves of immigration from the 1800s through the present. But there is also incredible diversity in language use in different areas of the state and even within single cities. A new book written by a collection of linguistic scholars expounds on our state's history, policy, and culture towards language use. Eric Ramey, professor of English language and linguistics at UW-Madison, and Thomas Purnell, professor of English at UW-Madison, are the co-editors and their contributors to Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. They spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Bloom about Wisconsin's rich cultural and linguistic heritage, which extends to both accents and dialects.
Wisconsin has been known for having a particular sort of accent or dialect from the upper Midwest area, and people tend to joke about that and think primarily in those terms. But there's a lot going on with language here that's sort of separate from English. In our book, we have a chapter on Native American languages, and I think this is the starting point, but also taking through immigration, both old immigrants like German, Polish, and also new immigrants such as Hmong and Spanish speakers. We picked four communities that we were very interested in because we felt that they had unique characteristics. So we picked Milwaukee because we felt like with the African-American community and the intersection with and sort of the issue of race and language, that was really important. We also picked Wausau because we felt like that was important because they had two groups of old immigrants and two groups of new immigrants. And we wanted to try to see how we could help them to learn from the past of the old groups. We also picked Mineral Point because we felt like that was very different. It's a different part of the state altogether in terms of the speech patterns. We felt like that was an important
– Southwestern.
Southwestern, right. And then we picked Rhinelander, which also was important for sort of as a center for Native American language issues as well as also for issues dealing with the North Woods aspect, that both the perception of North Woods individuals and also their language might be different from sort of this Germanic – you know, dominant area in the southeast.
I noticed that in many instances, members of various immigrant and native communities were forced to assimilate their language and culture and conform to standard English. But then I was surprised to read that Wisconsin actually established an emigration office in the mid-1800s, specifically to attract Germans to settle the state. Do you think that this cultural acceptance of Germanic culture affects the way we speak in Wisconsin today?
That's a good question. Not being from Wisconsin here, I think the history of actually trying to recruit or advertise Germans to come here specifically explains and provides, you know, the basis for why so many Germans came here. We can see the hallmarks of the large amounts of European migration in here in contemporary dialects of Wisconsin. But whether this actually leads to more acceptance of immigrants or immigrant languages here or there, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think that's still for us to decide in the future of how we treat new immigrant languages and old immigrant languages too.
But I think when you look at all these cases in the book, the immigrants come here, period, and then language issues follow. And so those language issues and follow sort of fall out in a particular pattern. And there's a lot to be learned from some of those patterns, like the German pattern, how German, in a sense, was used in Milwaukee particularly or throughout the state, but then has sort of given way to English in many ways and how they were in tension for a while. And then you see that now, I mean, with Spanish and with Hmong, how within those communities there's also a tension and how there's a transition taking place. And we have a lot to learn from what happened with those older immigrants with the new immigrants.
That is true. In my personal opinion, one of the most interesting things here is actually the difference between the older immigrants and the newer immigrants in that it appeared that it took the older immigrants, so the good old German immigrants, much, much, much longer to transition over to English as opposed to the new immigrants, especially the Spanish-speaking immigrants. They are transitioning over to English much quicker now, like as quickly as they possibly can, as opposed to the older immigrants that took three, four generations to do so.
And some of that has to do with societal pressures. So there's a lot of framework with regard to schools, churches, and family life in terms of having immigrants come in or old immigrants come in. And with the state, in a sense, advertising come here, you had some setup and some tolerance of that. And I think nowadays there are still churches. There are churches that have Hmong that's spoken in or Spanish. You'll see once those start to switch over to English, then you're going to start to lose a lot of the language. There's not a lot of the other structure. There are, you know, tiendas and so on and so forth, and those help maintain. So having, say, a hairdresser who speaks Hmong and then the Hmong go there, that'll preserve the contact because you're engaging it in the language at that point. And without some of those structures and some of those peripheral things, the turnover is much faster. I think some of the pressures in society now are not as supportive of language maintenance as they were in the past.
So there is a big community element in the practice of these languages.
Correct.
What are some of the linguistic mannerisms that are found in Wisconsin, and why is it important that we know about them?
It's always important to sort of know where you're from. That's one aspect of it. And it's also important to know where the other person that you're talking to is from. And identity and cohesion in a conversation is important to anybody. So usually when students live in Wisconsin and then they go out of the state for a while, all of a sudden it's apparent that something's different about their speech. And there's a number of markers, both in syntax and in the sounds, and then in also the words that they use. And those markers mark them out as being different from the place that they've gone to visit. Something that we might actually associate more with Chicago, which is de Bears, de Bulls. But you find this also in Packers, right, where people will make an S sound when it should be like a Z sound. But this happens in German, it happens in Dutch, it happens in a number of languages. And we wanted to look at the influence. We found that younger speakers actually took that as a marker and worked that into their speech more often than, say, even their previous generation. And that was remarkable. So that got us thinking that there's a lot going on in Wisconsin that's really interesting.
One of my favorite discussions in class is telling the class of, you know, nice Wisconsin-born students and all of you Wisconsin listeners that Wisconsin is unique and weird in having the past tense of the verb to dive into a pool as dove. And this is unusual with the rest of the country. And so when people occasionally look down on somebody for using the wrong tense of something, it makes people rethink their judgments when they find out it's like, oh, by the way, you know, your behavior of I dove into the pool, people not from around here may hear you say that and think that, you know, you're uneducated because obviously the past tense is dived. So one of the things of knowing what are the unique markers of a particular community or a speech group, I think allows people to think about their own judgments about differences in other groups of speeches.
And you bring up an interesting point, I think, about what we consider standard English and how there are actually many different types of standard English. Some forms might use a different past tense, like dove, as you mm-hmm. said. In academic settings, what we call formal standard English is usually used. But what makes this different from some of the other forms of standard English? What about informal standard English?
Oh, the different types of formal versions of language is really defined by kind of who makes the decision or who defines what is standard or not. So formal standard English is defined by groups of experts and basically books. And we also want to recognize that the only really real version of formal standard English is written English, is that it's only when it's written can it actually be formal standard. And you can look up in a book, Descriptive Grammar of English, of the writing rules of this is how you do it. The informal standard of English is a variety spoken, and this is completely defined by local communities. So using dove as the past tense of dive is standard here in Wisconsin because that's how the community behaves. The community has decided for that. It is not standard, say, in Western Pennsylvania where I grew up. And so the standards really differentiate by who has the power to decide what they are. And the version that everybody thinks exists, this formal standard English, is just purely in books. Whereas the actual, you know, in my opinion, more important, the local informal standard is completely community driven. And it's the community that you grow up with and feel most comfortable with and belonging to. Everybody learns what the standards are there on their own. And then you can see where people deviate from them.
The greatest deviation usually occurs in ones that are ethnically affiliated. Historically, in the United States, that's been with the African-American English community in terms of the choices that that community makes about language. They're not really choices in the sense that we think, oh, okay, I'm going to make this choice. I have a choice that way. But in terms of the way that it's developed over time and the whole history of African-American English, it sets itself out from standard white English in many particular ways. So that whole issue about standardization, particularly in the schools, in terms of the workplace, those are going to come up strongest in communities that have the most divergent speech forms, generally African-American English speech communities and also, say, even the Chicano English speech community.
Do you think that it's important that children are introduced to these different forms of English in school, that they have an understanding of dialects different than their own?
That's actually important. So there's two ways to take your particular question. One way to take it is a child who speaks a non-standard variety, should they be exposed, say, to others' varieties such as standard? And so that's generally the sort of big thing talking about education and how non-standard dialect speakers should conform or not conform. But also the other way around, for standard students who are close to the standard, individuals close to the standard, should they be exposed to more non-standard varieties? And I think in many ways they are exposed to non-standard varieties through media and so on and so forth, also through their friends if they have more contact with non-standard speakers. And I think that's healthy just to understand it. If they also understand that the forms that other people speak are not right or wrong, then they don't develop some of the biases that we use that as a flag for that person who's different later in life. And it's very important. Although language gets used that way sort of automatically, we use it as a flag and it ends up being used in discriminatory ways. So I think it's important for children early on in schools not to be sort of homogenizing the community and then making those who can't manage that variety as being very different.
I really don't think the idea that kids aren't being exposed to varieties of non-standard dialects can be maintained at all, because even in standard Wisconsin English, all the children are being exposed both to the informal standard but then also the vernacular non-standard. You know, so like all of the kids know all the bad words. They hear us when we're talking freely. And so they're aware of variation in language there too. So if we begin to ask the question of like, is it helpful or harmful of them being exposed to other informal standard or other informal non-standards, they're already seeing and aware of the variation to begin with. And so I actually think in school, if you actually – the younger that you can start talking to the kids about this and teaching them about this, the better they can begin to manipulate and use and know, you know, you don't say those words because you don't say those words in those situations. And, you know, this other person talks differently, but that's just because they're from a different neighborhood and it doesn't mean anything like that. And so you can begin the discussion of manipulating language behaviors for everybody, which everybody does, in more productive ways. You know, so you teach people to go to job interviews in, you know, nice clothes. You know, you teach people to use nice language when you go to a job interview. But, you know, when you're sitting around on the playground with your friends, you don't have to use nice language, and it's okay.
Eric Ramey and Tom Purnell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Eric Ramey is professor of English language and linguistics at UW-Madison, and Thomas Purnell is a professor of English at UW-Madison. They're the co-editors and they're contributors to Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State, published by UW Press. They spoke with Rachel Bloom. We'll continue a conversation about linguistic diversity next with one expert who says it can have a profound effect on how kids are taught in schools. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.